The deep dives roll on with a discussion of the backup bigs, Cantor, Rob, Grant. Who do you trust in the playoffs? It's the Wednesday Locked On Celtics. Millie, let's go. Rainy J's back with the vengeance. Back. All the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. The crowd goes crazy. Most in-depth coverage on the daily. Mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings. Focus like Danny at the deadline. Global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line. Play it in between time. I'ma throw my Siege jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day. Trying to stay in tune with the Siege, it's the best way. Melly.
Wednesday, middle of the week, for those of you still going to work, good luck to you. Hope everything is safe. Hope you're doing well. Thank you for continuing to listen to this podcast. Still making this podcast number one across the podcast platforms. Really appreciate all of the good reviews, the good written reviews. There are opportunities to advertise on this podcast. If you have a product you think is good at this time of year, something that people who are quarantined might want to buy or participate in, please drop me an email, lockedonceltics@gmail.com. Advertising space is available. The podcast is still doing pretty well. So unique opportunity here. You never know what you might be able to latch on to. So I'm John Corrales of MassLive.com. Today, joined by Chuck McKinney of RedsArmy.com. Chuck, how you feeling?
Wonderful. I'm in a deep, dark depression.
Yeah.
How about yourself?
I've tried to remove myself from reading news as often as I did, trying not to tweet about it as much because I'm just getting angry about things. So, you know, but I'm doing all right.
No, so I shouldn't joke. I mean, I'm doing well. I'm working. No one in my immediate family is sick. My kids are, you know, head down with their remote learning. So everything's going well. It's just the grind, you know, that wears you down. And like you said, you pick your head up for a moment and you watch some of the news and you see some of the stupidity and you see some of the greed. And then there's more stupidity and there's more greed. And you're just like, holy crap.
Yep.
So much for this country coming together. If it's happening, aside from the medical professionals on the front lines, I'm not feeling it. So I need to back off. And there's very little distraction. You know, I can't tell you how, I mean, it's no secret that we're huge sports fans, but when you take it all away from us at once, it's just a gaping hole. There's just a gaping hole in my life. When it's, you know, it's more than just watching the live event. There's just less to read about. There's less recap shows to watch.
Yeah.
Everything. So, that's got me down, but you know, you reached out and said you needed some assistance this evening. So I'm raring and ready to go.
Hey man, we're still trying to talk basketball. We're still trying to maintain some level of normalcy here on the podcast. You know, it is what it is. And obviously like every podcast starts with our, you know, some thoughts on the day's events, because this is a huge thing in history. You know, hundreds of years from now, this is going to be a thing in the history books that people are going to read about. And, you know, this is important. It's important to talk through it. So, and, you know, obviously it impacts the sport that we love. And today, Adrian Wojnarowski on ESPN reported, not basically saying that nothing's been ruled out, even playing an NBA Finals in late September, which would be kind of wild. Still not sure how it would be done, where it would be played, all of that. We had a big discussion, by the way, on Locked On NBA, me and Jake Madison on the Wednesday Locked On NBA show. So very in-depth discussion there about this topic. But Chuck, the season continuing to that point, I mean, you're talking about permanently impacting the NBA, I think. Like that, how do you get back to a regular schedule, a regular season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my first reaction was, really? I mean, why wouldn't they just hold off another month and start the new season? So, you know, obviously I get it. They, you know, they want to have those finals, those playoff games, that playoff revenue. They want those games televised. I think we're all chomping at the bit, but you know, when that's done, you're right. Like what happens next? I mean, does this lead to that permanent change where, you know, the season, and future seasons starts much later in the year? And that's just a fascinating sort of, aspect to this. Because if you just project out and you say, okay, we have the finals in September, they don't start the following season until, I don't know, December, then unless you're consolidating the regular season, which would result in lost revenue if there are consolidated games, then you're going to have a problem in 2021. So what is done there? Is it just another season that's in flux? It's unbelievable. And I think it's so hard to kind of they must have a giant board with all these different scenarios on them, because everything is so fluid. But it's really fascinating, and like you said, it's just not something that's going to impact at least, you know, this sports league for this year. It could you know, bring about substantive change to the league schedule that lasts you know, for the foreseeable future.
Yep. And think about, like, I think in a bubble, changing the NBA season like it was suggested by the Hawks, Hawks owner, would be interesting. Like, if this is just the new normal, like NBA finals are played in September and you have basically, you know, October, November off and training camp starts in December and the season starts in the middle of December or whatever, Christmas. And the unofficial start of the season becomes the official start of the season. Mm-hmm. That's like, all right, well, yeah, I can see that. But the entire world of basketball is a winter sport. They play it from September-ish to May, June-ish. Every league in the world does that, except for the WNBA. Which would be impacted. Like, if the NBA is playing during the summer, when does the WNBA play? Do they also play in the summer? Who's gonna that would really have a detrimental effect on the WNBA. What about, like, the progression is kids come out of college, they get drafted in June, they go to summer league in July, and then they start getting signed. Either the drafter, the guys who got drafted, you know, their contracts, the guys in the second round who maybe, like, Javonte Green. Javonte Green's a great example here, who showed out in summer league, and the Celtics had Max Strus, and they had to, like, play some kind of roster games to cut Strus, not screw him over, sign Javonte, and then get him, you know, after camp, you know, on the team. And he's had an impact this season. That story doesn't happen in this new version of the NBA because there is no summer league right after college. Right. He doesn't come in. Like, these guys, those fringe guys, have to make a decision because every other league in the world starts in September or October. And if the NBA is playing their finals at that time, these guys have to make decisions. And they're going to have to go play somewhere else and then try to – what are they come in and become, like, all of a sudden the buyout deadline, that becomes, like, sign overseas guys deadline. Like, there's so many ways that is – little things that – are part of NBA business that will hurt, that will get hurt by something like this. And I don't know. My prediction is that this might be the opportunity to go to, like, a 70 game schedule or 72 game schedule. And you slowly start to, like, cut back, and maybe they cut back the off season by a little bit or something. Maybe they make an exception for next season. And they slowly start to try to get back. Maybe they can modify the start and end dates a little bit, but I think you might see, like, this is the chance that they'll have to cut a few games out of the regular season.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. Just thinking of from the NCAA to the leagues overseas, you're right. That would just be there's so many implications there if the NBA were to alter its schedule, and I hadn't even thought that far down. So maybe they do try to just hedge their bets a bit. Wow, there's just the domino. there's so much there.
A lot of dominoes.
You know, it's just even, you know, how they just clash with other sports, you know, teams that have, like the Celtics, for example, and the Bruins, how they share the arena and everything. Like, there's just so many logistical things that need to be sorted out that it's giving me a headache.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, think about all the musical acts that go on tour in the summer.
Yeah.
You know? And now all of a sudden the Celtics are occupying the Garden in the summer. Like, what happens in the winter when the Celtics had those dates? You know, what happens in the first 2 months of when the Celtics had those dates? Like you said, logistical nightmare. So, all right. A lot to think about when it comes to all this. We are going to take a bit of a deep dive into the backup bigs. So we've done, if you haven't heard all of our shows yet, if this is your first time tuning in or whatever, last week we did a deep dive on all five starters. So that was Monday through Friday last week. This week, Monday was a goofy mailbag, and yesterday we did Marcus Smart. Today, backup bigs. We'll talk about the backup bigs when we come back on the Locked On Celtics podcast.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Coming into the season, there were serious questions about the center spot. Now, we already talked about Daniel Theis and how surprised we were at how good he's been and how much he's fit. Chuck and I talked about that last Friday. But there are still questions about what happens behind him. And now that Robert Williams is healthy, and whenever the season does return, assuming it does, the Celtics will have Robert Williams at 100%. They'll have Enes Kanter. If there's a silver lining for him at this point, that hip injury, he's now has time to heal, so he should be, you'd hope, close to 100%, if not 100% when he returns. But Chuck, when you looked at the way these bigs were kind of constructed coming into the season, what did you think? What were your expectations versus the reality?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I knew there was a glaring hole, and I had hoped, you know, I'd really was forced to follow my heart and hope that Rob Williams would take a step. You know, there were some folks out there who were advocating that he spend the league the season in the G League. I can't remember who that was, but for me, it was, let's see, he clearly has enough raw athleticism and that he can be a defensive force. Would he be smart enough to know how to handle rotations and switches and all that other crap? So, but I was hopeful that he could emerge a bit. Now, we didn't really see that, obviously. But it's been the surprising play of Theis that's just, you know, blown everybody away. So, and he's really calmed the, calmed down that position. So for me, it was, we'll get a little bit of, you know, in the preseason, right? I mean, I knew what Kanter was going to bring. And I thought they would, you know, have enough bodies to patch it together, but Rob Williams would kind of emerge. Clearly that didn't happen for, you know, health reasons, and then, like I said, we've seen Theis, who's just played out of his mind this year, and nobody really predicted that. So I guess you could say, moving forward, if there, you know, we do see a playoffs, now that Williams is healthier, maybe he can finally contribute, you know, and if Theis is logging a majority of the minutes, maybe Williams on a, you know, on a smaller sort of scale can contribute, you know, like I thought he might be able to do before the season started, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, that does. I think, like, coming in, I wasn't sure if Kanter was going to become the starter or the backup. I'm glad things have worked out the way they did. it makes more sense having him coming off the bench. And for a while, like there was a run in December where he was a big reason why the Celtics were winning. I mean, his production off the bench was really, really helpful. If we look at, I'm trying to go through his splits right here. December and January where he averaged 11.3, in December he averaged 9.5 points per game, shot 59%, 62.9%, so about 60, a little over 60% over those 2 months, was averaging just over 3 offensive rebounds per game. I mean, those were his two like clearly best months, and he had a big impact on the Celtics kind of like pulling through some games where I think when they started to kind of falter at the beginning of January, like we started to see some of the things that why Cantor was helping. These guys were missing shots and he was tipping them in. And but aside from that little burst, he's been like back to who we thought he was going to be. So I will acknowledge that Cantor had a stretch where he was very good, or I don't want to say very good, good, better than we thought. But then since then he's, and I think part of it has to do with the hip, he's struggled. But he's also, I think now that Robert Williams is healthy, and we're going to throw Grant Williams into this mix a little bit too, but mm-hmm. now that Rob is back and healthy, if they start the season back up again and they're all 100%, Cantor won't play in some of the games where he really struggled. Like in the past 15 games or so, Brad Stevens kind of threw Cantor out there just to kind of see, like, is he going to get torched? And then he did like DNP in the second half. After he did actually get torched, Rob can go in there and maybe be a little bit more productive, and Grant Williams can go in there. He's a rookie, and he's still prone to making mistakes, but I guess the types of mistakes that you're willing to live with is really what we're boiling down to here. Which of these backup centers are you going to go with? Depends on which types of mistakes you're willing to live with as Brad Stevens.
Yeah, absolutely. That's 100% right. I mean, I always, you know, thought Cantor's value would, you know, come in that, you know, late in that first quarter and part of that second quarter. The bench's offensive production is a bit thin. So I always thought he could contribute in that area. And like you said, sometimes we see him play early and then we don't see him again, because depending on who they're playing, they start to target him. So you know, and Brad's clearly going to shorten the rotation in the playoffs, so there's going to be less sort of maybe game by game experimenting, but I do like what you said about, you know, having Grant later in the games. I mean, there have just been some moments where he's just been tough. He just, you know, you can count on him to make the hustle play, to bust his ass for rebounds, even getting some offensive rebounds. So it's hard though, right? I mean, because from, you know, game to game in a series, Brad's not going to. He's not, I mean, maybe I'm wrong in assuming this. He's not going to go from Cantor to Grant to Rob, right? He's going to probably have his guy in mind for that particular series. He's going to go in with a sense for how the matchups are, yeah. And then more or less stick with that guy, right?
I would think so. I mean, you'd know, obviously you have to be flexible, but you know who's got what strengths on the other team. And when you could use certain guys, like you might be in a game where you say, all right, we're not going to use Cantor here, but all of a sudden, like your team is cold and you say, well, we need somebody. we need scoring, and why don't we see if Cantor can come in for a few minutes and put back some of these misses, at the very least. Like, that's one option for a short-term kind of like an injection, a Band-Aid, where, like, guys just happen to be off. You're like, well, if Cantor can go in there and clean up some of these misses, then all of the misses don't hurt quite as much, and we can get back right and set a defense. You know, so that's an option. I think I've seen Brad do that before. But, you know, there's also, you can't do that against a good pick and roll team. Like, against Oklahoma City, you just can't do that with Chris Paul running pick and roll. You're just going to get destroyed. Like, you're just going to get crushed. So any positive impact that he might have, you take it away on the other end. The one thing that just drives me nuts about Cantor, as helpful as he can be in certain situations, it's almost like a catch-22. I going back and watching film and watching some of the things, like, I'm putting together this thing. We talked about Marcus Smart yesterday. And I'm looking at his stats, Marcus Smart's. So last season, Marcus Smart took 26 shots from 10 to 14 feet. This season, he's already taken 57 from 10 to 14 feet. A large percentage of those, as I go through and look at the film, pick and rolls with Enes Kanter, who rolls to the basket and sets up for basically an offensive rebound. But what he does is he takes the big all the way down with him, and now Smart's not going to drive all the way to the rim. So now Smart's pulling up from the middle of the lane and shooting floaters, shooting short jumpers, shooting 15-footers. That is a material impact on the rest of the team. Yeah, yeah. I've seen Tatum. I've seen other guys. You run a pick and roll with Cantor, and as soon as the ball handler turns, Cantor's diving way down to the front of the rim. And you're like, okay, I get, like, that's where he's most effective. That's the spot where if Cantor's on the floor, he's most effective in that spot. But at the same time, you just pull the defender into your teammate's way. And, like, sometimes you've just got to – you've set the pick, take the screen assist, and go. You know, like, just go down the other end of the floor, get the hell out of the way, and let these guys do their thing. So it really is – that's the spot. When I see that happening on the floor, that's when I really start to lose my mind with him on offense.
But so that's an interesting stat that you dug up on Marcus, because it supports – the eye test supports it. I you know, had you asked me without giving me those numbers, I'd say it feels like he's shooting more of those mid-range shots, but it also feels like he's making more of those mid-range shots.
Yes, he's shooting. By the way, just so you to your point, last season he shot 38.5% on those. This season, while he's taking a lot more, shooting 49%.
Okay, so you're kind of upset with Cantor a bit, but in a way, it's having a positive effect. Can we kind of couch it to say it's somewhat positive?
I mean, it's not all the time. Like, it's not negative. Yeah. Like, without me going through, like, I don't have synergy. But so without me going through every player's pick and rolls with Cantor, like, the way to do it, I guess, like, scientifically, is break down all of the pick and rolls with Enes Kanter. You know, what shots are those players getting? What percentage are they hitting in that range? And all the other pick and rolls with Tice and Rob and Grant Williams. And to be fair, Grant Williams was one of the people who were, you know, was diving to the rim as well. It's not 100% Cantor all the time. It's just mostly Cantor. But if there's a way to do it without me having to, this is somebody with synergy can do this. It's like lighting a fire with a blowtorch, and me with the tools I have, it's like rubbing sticks together. but that's the way to look at it, is to see what shots players are getting in non-Cantor pick and rolls versus the Cantor pick and rolls. But I'm telling you, I bet you there's a significant increase in mid-range shots when he's on the floor. And it depends on who's taking them. You know, Tatum, for all of the stuff that we've loved about him, he's terrible in the mid-range. He's shooting like 40% at best on mid-range shots. Like, some of those shots that Smart's hitting 49%, like, Tatum's shooting like 38% or something. It's bad.
Wow. Well, I feel like Tatum is really like, if he has an opening, he's going to the rim, and I would just speculate that maybe most of those mid ranges are difficult contested shots.
Sure. Yes.
Again, blatant speculation. I have no evidence to support that, because he's been such a beast going to the rim. I feel like when he has a step or a lane, he's going all the way. At least that's what it seems like to me. So we're talking about the backup bigs looking back, but if we project forward again to the playoffs, it caught my eye that Tice is averaging about 24 minutes a game. Most of the starters are probably going to pick up another 3-plus minutes a game, right? They're going to go from that 32, 33, sure. 30, 36, 37, maybe a little more depending on how close the game is. Can Tice go from 24? Is Tice going to go from 24 minutes to 27 minutes, or is he going to go from 24 minutes to 34 minutes? Can he play that much more, or is that, you know, going to the well too often?
That's a tough question, and I'm going to answer that after the break here on the Locked On Celtics podcast. Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram. We left the last segment on a cliffhanger. How many minutes will Daniel Tice play? I'm going to assume that he's going to get a bump just like everybody. I think, honestly, it's going to depend on what kind of foul trouble he's in. And I think Brad probably wants to play him 30 to 32 minutes. But, you know, he's not perfect. He's going to have matchup issues himself. There are going to be games where it's like, you know, how many times have we seen Brad pull Tice like right away? What game was it? I want to say, shit, it was a road game where Utah? I don't know. But there was a game where Tice comes out in the second half or whatever, and takes the floor, gets beat, and then Brad like pulls him like right away. So I'd like to think that Stevens would say this is the plan, but he's also got a quick trigger with Tice. Tice gets into foul trouble, and you have, again, with everybody healthy, options. Cantor, is it the right matchup for Cantor or not? Is Rob Williams an option here or not? Is Grant Williams an option here or not? And he can kind of like try to plug and play and see which one of these guys is going to be right. You know what? You'll get this reference. Younger people won't get this reference. It's kind of
great.
it's kind of like rabbit ears on a TV with the center spot, where Brad Stevens is constantly going to be moving things around until he finds like the right reception, and the wind blows. You remember doing this. I remember doing this. The wind blows and all of a sudden the reception goes and you got to like move the rabbit ears again. And like if you change teams, if you play a different team, you change the channel, you got to move the rabbit ears a different direction.
And absolutely.
That's kind of what the center spot is going to be for the Celtics.
Well, you'd find that perfect spot. Then you'd be like, nobody move.
Yeah, right.
Don't go too quickly because a sudden shift in weight could throw off the signal. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at. But for me, I still think their best chance of winning is to have Tice has to play 30 to 32.
Yep.
They may have to slog through some tougher matchups, but I think him being on the floor more than those other guys is their best bet for you know advancing you know deep into the playoffs. That's just my feeling, and I hope you know Brad is willing to roll the dice there. I think he's gonna have to.
I guess it comes down to this, Chuck. Let me ask you. how much do you trust these backup centers in a playoff series?
Well, the fact that I have to really think hard about it means I don't.
Right.
And like you said, it's probably trusting Brad's gut more with pushing the right, with finding the right, you know, mix than it is trusting a particular player, right? It's like, I trust Brad to put Cantor in the right spots,
right,
more than I just flat out trust Cantor, or that I flat out trust, Rob Williams. So, I think I've artfully dodged your question.
Well, okay. So it boils down to, like, when we talk about trust, like, we talked about Cantor a lot so far. You started out talking about Rob Williams, and let's go back to him, because he can be really good. The biggest obstacle for Robert Williams, I really do believe the biggest obstacle for Robert Williams is Robert Williams, where it's all in his mind. And is he focused enough? Is he doing the things that he needs to do? Like we've said all along, is he in the right position? Is he down low enough? Is he biting on fakes? Is he chasing blocks? Or is he sliding and guiding a guy away from the rim rather than turning his hips and chasing and trying to block the shot? And by that, putting himself out of position. Like, I really think Robert Williams has the potential to be the most impactful center that they have. Like, if he can rise to Daniel Tice's level of intelligence at that position, if he can do the things that Daniel Tice does in terms of calling things out, sliding, being in a good position, reading things, reacting to things, rather than rely, like Robert Williams has these old habits, things that he's been able to do and get away with for so long, and it doesn't work all the time at this level. This level demands perfection. It demands a level of polish on your game that Robert Williams doesn't have, or doesn't have consistently enough anyway. Yeah. Like, if Robert Williams something can click and he can be focused and he can do those things instead of falling into the old habits, then I think a combination of pick and pop Daniel Tice type of guy and rolling hard and creating that pressure on the rim guy from, like, on Rob Williams, that combination can be perfect for the Celtics, because that's all they need from those guys, and the other guys in the perimeter do everything else.
Right. Yeah, so I guess, you know, just thinking about your question a bit more, and just listening to, you know, your analysis of Rob Williams. So I'm more apt to trust Cantor in this, you know, if there's the playoffs, I would trust Cantor more. I mean, you just look at the body of work for the whole team, right? Top five defense, Cantor's played 51 games or whatever. Mm-hmm. Out of the 60 something or other. So he's played a good chunk of games, fair amount of minutes. I just think, I'd be more willing to, you know, I would trust Cantor. I would be more willing to believe that we would get something out of him, offensively, that might offset some of the defensive slip ups. Whereas with Rob, I don't think, you know, I'm not confident we would get anything from him. Like, it could be an all or nothing,
right,
where you get explosive Rob, where he's dunking and he's blocking shots, or he's just out of, you know, the out of position Rob, like you talked about. So probably, but, you know, going forward, obviously my chips are, you know, my eggs are in the Rob Williams basket.
Sure.
But forced to choose, if I had set a rotation before the playoffs were to start, you know, I guess I would pick Cantor, I guess.
Look,
I talked myself into hedge away at the end, but I pick Cantor.
I mean, look, Cantor is the proven entity. Like, after Yusuf Nurkic went down last year for Portland, Cantor stepped in. And everybody's like, oh, shit, But Cantor stepped in and was fairly impressive for Portland. That he did a pretty good job, and that was tough for him, but he did it. And so there is recent history on his side that he can step up and find a way to be effective in the playoffs.
Yeah.
You know, but again, a lot of it is matchup based. And now this wrap things up with, where does this leave Grant Williams in all of this? Cause you talked about, like, I think Grant does so much well, and I don't think that he's one to be phased. Like, it's a playoff series, and maybe, you know, he obviously doesn't know what to expect, how different playoff basketball is than regular season basketball. But at the same time, if there is a playoffs this year, it's not going to be the same kind of playoff basketball. Like, if the Celtics play Philly in round one, they're not going to Philly to face that crowd, you know?
Interesting point. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, that's going to be a weird playoff. So my first point against Grant would be like, you go into Philly, you see that crowd, you hear that crowd, you think the regular season was something. Wait till the playoff Philly crowd is nuts. But what if the playoffs are played at like a Wichita State, and it's just an empty arena at some location, some kind of like neutral location? Where the hell are they going to play these games? That takes away a lot of the things that would normally hurt a rookie in a playoff situation.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, I would think that would impact even all the players to some degree as they at least when they, you know, getting started. But that's an interesting point that kind of softens the pressure. You know, I don't know. There are only so many minutes to go around, and I would think he. But you're right. He's just so solid. He's so solid in certain areas that in a playoff series there's value to. But I still get the sense that something would have to be going wrong for Brad to go to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, like he's tried Williams or Cantor, or Cantor's getting toasted. I don't know if he would go consistently to Grant.
No, I mean, it's going to be hard for a rookie to get that level of trust. But I also say that Grant's not a typical kind of rookie. And he does so many little things well that they might try him. It's such a different scenario for him. The only problem is, his 3-point shooting has been, you know, spotty.
yeah.
At best. Yeah. Let's look at his splits over the course of the season. Obviously he didn't hit anything in October and November. Then I started hitting him in December. January he shoots 43% from three. February he shoots 40% from three. And then in March he only is at 10%. Let me look at the totals here so we can see how many threes that he's hit. He was 1 for 10 in March. So if we get the guy who shot, let's see, 15 for 36 over the course of 28 games in January and February, then leaving him alone, which teams I think would do.
Yeah, of course.
When he's on the floor, then that wouldn't be too bad, because, you know, if you can trust him, and obviously he's not going to shoot 40% in the playoffs, but if he can just hit enough, just need to hit enough for teams to be like, okay, we can't leave him alone. But you get 1 for 10 in March, or, 0 for 21 in October, November. I forget what the entire streak was, but if we get that guy, then he's going to be left alone over and over and over again, and he's going to shoot it, because when you're left alone, you're going to shoot. What else are you going to do?
Yeah.
You're going to dribble handoff into the teeth of a double team? Like, what are you going to do? It becomes like Marcus Smart 2 years ago when I forget what playoff game it was, where, you know, shoots the ball wide open, nobody near him, shoots the ball, front rims it, it bounces back to him, steps back again, sets up, shoots the ball again, misses that one. Like that's going to end up being Grant Williams.
Yeah, he's going to have to make a few. And like you said, it only takes a couple. Yeah, that's tough. I just don't have a good feeling with him with him launching threes, even when he's, you know, got nobody within 7 feet of him. So that's a tough one. That's tough.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we have answers at some point. I'd love to see. I'm really curious to see what this playoff thing would be. Like, I've been thinking about this, and I wrote, you know, five hurdles that NBA needs to clear on Mass Live. Where they play these games is going to be so critical to some of the things that happen. Like, the entire course of the playoffs is going to change because some of these home crowds aren't going to be involved. Like, Utah or how about Denver? How about Denver not being playing? Like, are they going to play in altitude? Denver is such a great home team, partly because they play in altitude. What are they going to do with the playoffs? Are they going to play them at a neutral site where there's no advantage? You're just going to, like, change jerseys? Like, how do they do this? So, I don't know. That's all going to play a role in how these guys play.
That's nuts. You know, I guess I'd always figured they would still play in their home. Their hometowns, they just wouldn't be in front of crowds. But thinking of September is so far off. Are we still going to be social distancing in September?
I don't know, Chuck.
Please help me. Dr. Corrales, please help me.
The way I'm saying, are you talking about September of 2020 or September of 2021?
Oh, Jesus.
Because that's the way things are going now, man. I don't know. I don't think enough people take this seriously enough, including some very important people in charge, that I think we're going to be social distancing for a while. It's going to be interesting. I don't know how I'm going to do my job. I guess I'm just going to be watching on TV and doing a teleconference, post-game teleconference with Brad Stevens, FaceTime.
Oh, yeah, that's boy. Nuts. That's nuts.
Yeah. Anyway, so, all right, well, those are the big guys. That's our deep dive into the bigs. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Hope you've enjoyed it enough to subscribe. Give us that good 5-star rating. Give the show that good written review. Really appreciate this. Want to let everybody know that Locked On has a new podcast coming out for all you draft folk. Chad Ford, former ESPN draft expert. Now he's on Locked On doing a daily daily draft podcast that's going to start in a week. So tune in for that. Appreciate it. Thanks for listening, everybody. This has been the Locked On Celtics Podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.